solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Okay, so one of the things that we worry about is that if we don't discipline our kids when they're growing up, then they're going to end up being messed up. You know, they're not going to be able to be diligent in pursuing their passions. They're not going to put in those 10,000 hours, and they're not going to be successful. They're going to fritter it all away. And that's a big, deep worry that a lot of parents have, okay? And I'm not saying that discipline is not important, but I think it's a little bit less important than we think it is, okay? And if it comes to a compromise or a trade-off between love and discipline, I think that love should always trump. Love should always trump.
Welcome to the 56th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman, and I work with leaders as a coach, sounding board, or as a transition advisor as they navigate their journeys. In this series, we feature conversations from leaders from different walks of life on three themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. My guest this time is Professor Raj Raghunathan from the McComb School of Business at the University of Texas at Austin. He's an alumnus of IIM Calcutta and has pursued a career in marketing and academia, but he started researching happiness after he saw several smart and successful people around him being unhappy. He teaches a very successful online course on Coursera on happiness, named A Life of Happiness and Fulfillment, and has authored the book, If You're So Smart, Why Aren't You Happy? Before we dive into the conversation with Raj, a quick heads up on the next guest of the podcast. It's Jennifer Garvey Berger, an accomplished executive coach who's been studying complexity and leadership in a complex world for several years. You might want to look out for that conversation that will be published in a couple of weeks, as it has some really useful insights that could help us cope with the current COVID-19 situation we are in. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Raj Raghunathan. Raj, thank you so much for making the time on the Play to Potential podcast. Excited to be talking to you.
I'm very excited to be here, Deepak, as well. Thank you very much for inviting me.
And Raj, we'd love to talk about your insights based on your work in happiness. But before that, I'd love to talk about your journey and how you got here. You started out with degrees in engineering from BITS Pilani, and then you had an MBA from IMC and an early career in Lintas, the advertising agency. Talk to us about the transition to academics. How did that happen, and what drove that decision?
Yeah, so I think you and your listeners are going to be a little bit disappointed to hear the story, perhaps. But I really did not choose to come into academics. I just wanted to get out of India. Okay, this was, we're talking in the early 90s, when really we didn't have a whole lot of opportunities to travel abroad. And for me, that was very, very important. It was top priority in my life to travel, to see places and everything. And because I'm from a middle-class family, more or less the only way in which I got to travel abroad, I thought this was the only way I could do it, was to actually get a PhD, because master's and undergraduate degrees, you have to actually pay money. Sometimes you did get a scholarship as a master's, but as a PhD, you were guaranteed a stipend. And my parents did not have enough money to send me abroad for me to travel around. And so I came here to the US, really, believe it or not, just to travel abroad. Okay. But wow. Once I got here, something really interesting happened, which was that I really fell in love with studying. I was never really into studying. I mean, I was smart enough to get into BITS and IIM and everything, but I would just basically kind of flake. You know, once I was inside, I would just do the minimum, bare minimum possible to get to the next level, you know. But in the PhD program, I discovered that I was studying topics that were of inherent interest to me. So for the very first time, I was studying not for the sake of getting a job or grades or whatever. I was studying for the sake of exploring your topic. And so that's how I ended up here in the US.
Fascinating. Definitely didn't expect that. And even in your journey as an academic, you've transitioned from marketing, I think, to studying happiness and psychology and leadership and some of the related topics. How did you gravitate towards these topics along the way?
Right. So I was always very, very interested in happiness at a very personal level. And I suppose that you could say that that's what led me to come to the US. And, you know, after getting a degree in IIM, I would say that most people are very keen on taking advantage of the great degree that they have, right, to get into a good company and earn as much money as you can. Even back in those days, before India started really taking off, there were jobs that were paying quite well. Okay. So the fact that I chose to not do that and forego that, you know, earning potential and opportunity for earning to come and spend here time in the US 5 years, right, to get a PhD is a decision that, you know, most people wouldn't take lightly. But I wasn't taking it lightly, but I did. It was a no-brainer for me, you know. For me, I wanted to travel abroad, and that trumped everything else. And so I ended up doing it. Now, it's a good thing that it ended up being a good decision career-wise too, I would say. Now, and the same thing, similar kind of a phenomenon happened after I started teaching marketing in the marketing department. At some point, I realized that, hey, you know, I don't know if what I'm teaching is actually helping people out at the end of the day. You know, I'm giving them tools and skill sets needed to persuade other people to buy stuff that they may or may not need. And that's leading to consumerism. I don't know if the marketers are really happy about being somewhat manipulative agents. And I don't know if the consumers are ultimately happy buying things that they don't need. And the earth is definitely not happy. So that was one of the thoughts in the background of my mind. And then I went to India, took a bunch of MBA students from the Macomb School of Business to India, and as a part of a course called Global Connections. And I remember last day of that trip in 2006, I think it was, I turned around to them and asked them, how would you like if I offered a course on happiness? Okay, because for me, the ultimate purpose of education is to make the world a happier, more fulfilling place. I want my students to be happy. I wanted them to make other people happy. And I wasn't sure that the marketing courses were doing it. And so I turned around and asked them this question. And, you know, to a like one person, they all said to the very last person, they all said that they'd love to see a course like this. And that really did it for me. And then I came back and I put my course and, you know, in a way, it just took off more wildly than I would have ever expected. You know, it's been 10 years since that happened, since I first taught the course. This was, I told you, in 2006 or 2007, when I talked to the students, it took me a good three, 4 years to actually offer my very first course to the students here at the Macomb School of Business. So it's been 10 years since I've taught it. And as you know, there's two online courses now that I've offered. I go and teach the same course at ISB. I teach it both for MBAs and for undergrads. I get invited to give talks to organizations on the topic. And so it's really taken off in a way that I wouldn't have expected. And of course, I'm not complaining. So it's been a good ride.
Lovely, lovely. And maybe just going back to that piece around building capability, let's say the 3-4 years between when you sensed the demand from students and when you offered it. Talk to us about how you spent that time, Raj.
Yeah, so, you know, this was back in 2006-07, and there was no university professor, certainly no tenure-track professor, offering a course on happiness anywhere, as far as I could tell, in the US, okay? And so there was no real path that was already carved out for me. I couldn't buy a textbook and then just teach it from it. I had to literally sit down and read the papers and kind of structure it in the way that I thought fit. And so it took me a while, okay? And I went and sat in on a few courses that I thought were somewhat related to the topic. And a couple of courses were very related to happiness, but they were taking an entirely different approach. You know, I wanted mine to be very scientific, logical, amenable to a kind of a philosophical inquiry, if you will, a rationalistic approach, as opposed to a faith-based approach. And so it took me a while to kind of, you know, wrap my head around it and figure out what the content was going to be and how I was going to structure it. And I have to tell you that, you know, if somebody were to have sat in on that course now and they sit in on the course now that I teach now, they wouldn't be able to see any similarities at all. So it's changed even in the last 10 years. But because there was no other course like that, I had to spend a good amount of time kind of figuring out what it is that I wanted to say in the class.
Got it. And what are some of the dimensions in which it's changed since you mentioned it? What are the vectors of change?
So I would say that one similarity is that, you know, it's a course that starts out with what are our basic motivations in life, right? And then I end up saying, why do we have these motivations and how achieving them makes us feel happy? And in the very early days, I had these kind of buckets. And I said that, you know, you needed to have some level of basic need, some level of, you know, accuracy need, I called it at that point in time, some level of, you know, level of achievement need, some level of relationship need. And I conceived of all these as being buckets that are kind of hanging in space or on a pole, if you will, that is a horizontal pole. It's all hanging there. And the more one bucket gets full, you know, you need to also fill in other buckets. Otherwise, it gets lopsided. And it's not a very happy life. You know, it was kind of weird now that I think back on it. I don't know why I was thinking that way about these things. I felt that you needed to have a balance between all these things in order for you to be happy. And maybe to some extent it's true, but I've kind of now, the way that I've structured it, you know, it basically boils down to three very, very important goals. You know, I call them MBA goals: mastery, belonging, and autonomy. And then I have a couple of other things that are very important, but those are the three big goals. So I've gotten rid of this whole idea of the buckets, and they need to be in balance. And I had, I think, seven buckets. so it's changed quite a bit.
Got it. No, this reminds me of the work of Stuart Friedman, who was on the podcast a few months back. Mm-hmm. He talks mm-hmm. about self, work, home, and community. And he talks about some sort of a harmony, not quite the buckets that you spoke about, but at least those four dimensions.
I would say that, you know, that in a way was my idea as well, you know, that these need to be in balance, or harmony, you could call it harmony. I don't know if I think that way about it. I do think that it's nice if they're in balance or every one of them is fulfilled, but I don't necessarily think that having one fulfilled and the other not fulfilled is worse than having nothing fulfilled, you know. So in that way, my thinking has changed.
Got it. So let's dive into your work and happiness, Raj. Mm-hmm. And let's go. Let's start from ground zero, right? How do you define happiness? And I'm also curious about, you know, what are some of the common misconceptions you see in the way people think or define happiness? Mm-hmm. And maybe we pick it up from there.
Yeah, sure. So for me, happiness personally is a state of lightheartedness and a kind of state of joy, if you will, you know, about embracing life and feeling good about life and having a sense of joie de vivre, you know, that French talk about. And it comes with a lightheartedness. So even if you're doing something serious, not to take yourself too seriously, you know. But that lightheartedness, I don't think, in my definition, it should come at a cost to either your rationality or your sanity or at a cost to other people's happiness. So I don't want to sacrifice compassion in order to be happy myself. Okay, so that's how I personally define it for myself. But more academically, I would say that you can think of happiness as being kind of sourced in four different kinds of sources. Okay, so obviously, I think we can all agree that happiness is a positive emotional state. Now, the question is, how does that state get triggered? And what are the qualities of that state? And I would say that there are at least four different sources that I can think of. One is pleasure, right? Just sensory positivity, eating something tasty, smelling something good, and so on. The other is just positive emotions because something good is happening around you. You know, you're in a loving relationship, for example, or you achieve something that makes you feel proud. And we can think of at least, you know, 10, maybe as many as 20, 25 positive emotions, including gratitude and awe and humor and interest and pride. I already mentioned pride, serenity, and so on. Then there are two categories that I think are very interesting, which seem uniquely human to me. And one of those is sense of purpose, I call it. So this is engagement in an activity that is so deeply intrinsically motivating for you that you lose track of time in it. You know, you experience these flow states. And that is a source of positivity. And then you can think of what I call meaning, which is the satisfaction that comes from contributing to other people, helping them out. And all of us have this desire to be agents of positive change, even if we don't recognize it, even if we are hardcore, I don't know, economists, okay, not to kind of throw them under the bus or anything like that. But you know, everybody has, even if you really believe in this idea of, you know, self-rationality, right? I mean, this idea that you want to enhance your personal goals. I do think that you have a deep desire to help other people out. Okay. Now lots of new studies are coming out, and maybe we can talk about a couple of those. But basically, that is the fourth category, the satisfaction that you get from helping other people out. And I think you can define happiness as the positivity that comes from one of these four different sources. And sometimes, and this is where it gets interesting, in my opinion, maybe complex in somebody else's eyes, but you can have a kind of mixture of both positive and negative, in the sense that in the quest for contributing to other people, maybe let's say not even people, you know, animals, right? Protecting animals, you might have to take on a fight. You might have to put up with anxiety in you know, facing lobbyists, for example, or certain interested parties in order to fight for the rights of animals. And so in the end, it's a meaningful thing to do, but it comes at a cost to maybe your positivity, okay? But it's still a better life than to, you know, not take on that challenge. So that's, I don't know if that is in the ballpark of what you wanted me to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe to make it real, Raj, let's talk about a couple of segments, right? One is the students that you teach. Maybe just to take a reference point, people in their early 20s or late 20s. And the other is your peer set. I'm guessing 50 plus or minus, right? If I may use the term midlife broadly.
Sure.
As you look around, what are some of the themes where you think people get it wrong in the way they frame it for themselves?
Yeah, so one way in which people get it wrong, and it's not a very important way, or it's not a big concern, but they do, I think, get it wrong, is that they think of happiness as being ephemeral or fleeting or frivolous and not worthy of pursuit. Okay, I think that you know, you can think of happiness as an umbrella term that captures a lot of different types of positive emotions, not just pleasure, which would make it, I agree, somewhat superficial or frivolous and ephemeral, but also these other sources that I talked about, you know, of pleasure and in particular, sorry, positivity and in particular meaning and purpose, which can be quite deep and long lasting. Another way in which people get it wrong is that, first of all, I mean, this way that I talked about, it's not a big concern because you can just replace the word happiness with, say, fulfillment or positivity or, as some researchers do, subjective well-being. Okay, so if it's a definitional thing, then you can just use an alternative term and it's not a big concern. But another, I think, more important concern is that people think that happiness is, you know, they don't really want to be happy or something like that, you know. And I think that that is a bit of a concern because it turns out that happier people are more kind to other people. You know, they're also more healthy and they're also more functional. They end up achieving more. They're more creative. They're more objective. Lots of functional benefits that come from being a happy person, and they're foregoing that by not prioritizing happiness, okay, and prioritizing success instead, which is a common phenomenon that happens, that people go after money and all the extrinsic yardsticks of what's considered success and sacrificing their own happiness. And maybe at some level, you know, that's okay. You know, who's to say that, you know, everybody's got to follow this, but in the quest of that, they end up hurting other people too. They become too greedy and, you know, at a personal level, maybe more prone to divorces and things like that, but at a societal level, causing more harm for future generations or to animals or to poor people and so on. So that is one problem. And maybe at a kind of a, you know, another level, another misconception that people have is that pursuing happiness, and this is the other extreme, right? So one set of people kind of deny or decline happiness, but the other set of people kind of become overly keen on achieving it. And that is a misconception as well, in the sense that that is not the way to enhance your happiness level. So the important thing is to strike a balance, is to prioritize happiness, but not pursue it. And it's a bit of a difficult balance to pull off. And what it involves is to identify a set of things that reliably make you happy and then make those habits in your life and then forget about it, whether it actually makes you happier or not. You know, don't chase happiness. But in order for you to kind of evaluate and get to what set of things make you happier on a reliable basis, there is a phase in which you got to kind of monitor how happy it makes you and whether it makes you happy and so on. So there you are kind of concerned about and measuring how happy you feel compared to how happy you expect it to feel. But once you kind of put a set of habits in place, I think it's very, very important not to chase happiness because that ends up reducing your happiness.
Got it. And maybe before we dive into some of these topics, Raj, you know, going back to the term, what gets measured gets managed, right? And you talk about some of the people going after extrinsic measures. Let's take money as one of the examples, right? That's easy to measure. You know where you stand.
Yeah.
How do you measure happiness? And more specifically, is it something that is it more of an inner recognition that you're happy, or do people around us notice, or both? Give us a sense of how you think about measuring happiness.
Yeah. So There's a lot of work that's that got done between, I would say, 1980s, 85 or so, mid-80s to mid-90s. And a lot of the researchers were very interested in happiness, but they were also skeptical as to whether you can really measure it. You know, like you mentioned, money seems much easier to measure. It's quantifiable. Mm-hmm. Happiness seems like a subjective experience. If I say I'm a 9 out of 10, is it the same thing as if you say you're a 9 out of 10 and so on? So they ended up doing these studies in which they measured happiness through what are called self-reports. Basically, the simplest way to measure happiness is to ask people how happy they are, for example, on a 10-point scale. And then they looked at whether those measures that people gave are highly correlated with other measures, other more quote-unquote objective measures, like, for example, looking at levels of serotonin or dopamine or endorphins in your bloodstream, or cortisol, for that matter, which ought to be negatively correlated with happiness. They also looked at people's self-reports versus what other people that were close to these people said about these people's happiness. Let's say I say I'm a 9, and if you ask my wife, how happy is Raj? You know, if I'm not pulling a number out of thin air, I'm actually kind of, you know, aware of how happy I am, and I'm coming up with a number that's actually valid, then you would expect to see a higher correlation between my self-reports of happiness and other people, you know, particularly people who are close to me, their reports of how happy I am. You can also look at brain scans. You can look at certain areas of the brain that tend to get lit up, so to speak. It's more active. There's more blood flowing through to those parts of the brain. Certain parts of the brain are more well-developed. The left prefrontal cortex, for example, is more well-developed. So what the researchers ended up concluding is that these self-reports are pretty valid. They are quite highly correlated with these more objective measures of happiness than would be the case if they weren't valid. And so they ended up concluding that the simplest way to measure happiness is also a reliable way to measure happiness. So that's how, you know, I go about also doing happiness studies. You know, I just kind of measure happiness. I measure people's moods using relatively standardized but simple measures of happiness.
Got it. And in your work, you actually say that intelligence is possibly not related or possibly borderline negatively correlated to happiness.
Right. I mean, I haven't done any work myself on this, so I don't claim that I'm very knowledgeable about this. But to the extent that I've studied it in terms of other people's research on this, it doesn't seem like it's there's any correlation between standard kind of yardsticks of intelligence, you know, like IQ. Mm-hmm. Education levels and happiness levels. So there's a bit of an asterisk or a qualification here between being uneducated, let's say that you didn't even go to any school or college, and having an undergraduate degree, you're going to be happier with an undergrad degree. But beyond it, it seems that it doesn't really help any. And in fact, getting a PhD lowers your happiness a little bit.
And changes that at the undergraduate level? What's the delta?
What's the delta between uneducated and the undergraduate?
Yeah, in the sense, yeah. What is it? Is it just the economy? You cross that economic hurdle. And...
Right. So what is the cause for the change in happiness? Yeah. So, I do think that you have more opportunities, right? One thing that we know for sure, this may be the biggest determinant of your happiness, is whether you have access to basic needs or not, right? If you look at the happiest countries in the world, they tend to be countries in which most of the population has access to things like, you know, food and roof over their head and education and medical attention and transportation and so on. Basically, the countries that we call socialist countries, right? Finland, which has been, you know, number one for 3 years now in a row, is an example of that. So I think that education up to undergrad, especially compared to somebody who doesn't even have a high school degree, you know, they're going to do better in terms of access to basic needs. So that might be a big reason for it, for sure. And of course, you can also think of other associated reasons, which is a sense of, you know, self-worth, self-positivity, the kinds of people that you tend to hang out with, you know, who tend to be more intelligent, perhaps, you know, better company in terms of being engaging, you're doing better, more skilled labor, right? So there's just a variety of things that go together with being more educated than just having a high school degree that is going to be positive for you.
Got it. And it's interesting you say that once the undergraduate, after that, there's no significant difference between further levels of education.
Hmm? Right. So that's what I remember from these studies. And I have to say that, you know, what's undeniably true here is that there's lots of people who are not just very well educated and are smart, but are also very successful by conventional yardsticks, you know, in terms of fame, money, power, access to resources, and so on, status, and yet are miserable people. You know, in fact, I'd be surprised if every one of the listeners you have doesn't know at least one person like that, who's really wealthy, who's really successful by conventional yardsticks, and yet, to the extent that these people know them really well, they also know that they're deeply miserable. And so that is a very interesting phenomenon for me.
And moving to a different topic, Raj, you talk about, you know, abundance mindset versus scarcity mindset and the link with happiness, right? And and talk to us a little bit about how you think about these two and the link to happiness.
Yeah. So actually, this is a good context to talk about this one study that came out. It was summarized in an article in the Atlantic magazine. It came out in 2014. And the title of the study, the article was The Secret Fears of the Super Rich. Okay, Secret Fears of the Super Rich. And I believe it was a Harvard study. I'm forgetting who conducted it, but or Princeton study. But basically, they went around interviewing these high net worth individuals. Okay, and in order to qualify as a participant in the study, you needed to have $25 million invested in financial instruments, right? So this is money that's on the side, so to speak. You know, this is money invested in things like hedge funds or you know, other kinds of financial instruments. Is not counting your house, not counting your cars, not counting your other assets. And they interviewed them to ask them, what are some of your big fears? Okay. And one of the biggest fears that these people had is that they don't have enough money. Okay. So I know it sounds, and it's easy to point fingers at them and say that, you know, I wouldn't be like that. If I had $25 million, you know, I would definitely not be greedy for more money. Okay. But we all know that almost at every stage in our life, we do end up feeling that, you know, hey, you know what, more money might be actually good for me. Okay. And a part of that comes from comparing ourselves to other people. And as you rise up the social ladder, so to speak, the company that you keep changes. And so your comparison point changes too. And whereas when I was in India, for example, you know, having a kind of swimming pool in my own house might have been like something that, you know, was completely out of reach, right? To where I'm living now, I actually don't have a pool in my house, but I do have a hot tub, okay? But it doesn't seem like that's out of reach at all, okay? And so it definitely seems like, oh yeah, if I had enough money, then maybe I can do that. And I can add maybe a little movie theater in my house. So why should I have to go out and, you know, mingle with the hoi polloi, so to speak? I can just watch these movies in my own home, in the comforts of my home, and so on. So your kind of aspirations catch up, right? So that is a very interesting finding, that despite having so much money, these people were, you know, feeling that they didn't have enough. They were operating from a scarcity mindset, is how I would put it. And then you have the opposite end of the spectrum that is covered in this movie, this documentary called Happy. I don't know if you've seen it. I think it's still available on Netflix, and you can watch it. Your viewers, whoever's following this podcast can watch it as well. They start out with a scene in the slums of Calcutta, and the slum dwellers are all people who kind of pull rickshaws, right? You might have seen this. These are not like pulley rickshaws, cycle rickshaws. These are hand rickshaws, right? Yeah, so they're actually literally running around the city with passengers in their in the seat in their back. Sometimes these people are so malnourished that they don't even have, you know, they have bones sticking out of there, and they don't have enough access to resources to wear shoes. So they're running around, bloody feet, reed thin. And the researchers go to the slums and interview these people because they're very intrigued by this phenomenon where these people don't even have proper homes to live in. They're living in little slums, and their homes are basically tarpaulin sheets pulled over four sticks with holes in them so that when it rains, it's leaky and it's like miserable, okay? And yet they're all smiling and, if not happy, at least content. And so the researchers are kind of flummoxed by this sight. And so they go and ask them, how can you afford to be content and happy? And I'm paraphrasing what they say, but they basically say something along the lines of, you know what, we're taken care of. Okay, we're taken care of, and they believe in God or they believe in some kind of a spirit. And they say that whenever we need anything really desperately, we end up getting it. Okay, maybe not in the way that we conceive of it, maybe not immediately, but we end up getting it. And we have a good sense of community. Everybody in the slums takes care of each other. On the days I don't make a good tip, somebody else might make a good tip. And so they feed us, and likewise, we return the favor. And so what to complain about kind of a thing, okay? So in other words, their life circumstances are characterized by scarcity, right? Not just plain vanilla scarcity, but abject scarcity. And yet they have, if not a mindset of abundance, at least a mindset of contentment, okay? So no prizes for guessing which of these two groups of people is happier, okay? In the sense of who needs to take antidepressants just to stay afloat, right? Who needs to pop sleeping pills to fall asleep every night? It's the high net worth individuals, okay? Very, very interesting finding, right? So what I talk about as an abundance mindset is basically this idea that in your head, you feel that you have more than enough. And you would think it must be correlated with how much access to resources you actually have, objectively speaking. But in these examples that I just gave you, it appears not to be, okay? And certainly for people like you and me, and for people who are listening to this, I would imagine that most of them have enough access to enough resources that right now it's a question of whether you can kind of convince yourself that you have enough, right? And you can adopt that mindset of abundance. And if you do, you actually end up discovering, and you know, I have to tell you, Deepak, you know, I wasn't somebody who was born with an abundance mindset, or you know, certainly wasn't nurtured in me, and I had to kind of logically figure this out at some level, you know, and so at one point though, I just decided, you know what, I'm gonna conclude that I have enough, and I'm gonna operate in a fashion that perhaps is not like as abundance oriented as say Jesus might have been, or some other you know guru like that might have been. Or even people like Vinoba Bhave, right, might have been. But I'm going to, in my own way, kind of progress towards a greater and greater abundance. And that is one of the tasks that I've embarked on. And the interesting thing is, not only does it make you a happier person, it also makes you more successful, believe it or not. Okay. And to listeners of this, I would really highly recommend a book that I really loved reading. It's called Give and Take by Adam Grant, on how he's kind of, you know, he cites some 300 papers in that book. Okay, it came out in 2014, bestseller. And he basically kind of walks you through the logic behind why it is that what he calls givers rather than takers or even matchers are more likely to succeed. Okay, and in a nutshell, it has to do with what other people think of you. You know, who do you like to support? Would you like to support as a person who's a taker or a giver, right? So controlling for your quality of work, controlling for how accountable you are, your intelligence, your education, and all that, you're much better off being a giver rather than a taker. That is somebody with an abundance mindset rather than a scarcity mindset. Maybe I talked more in answering this question than you wanted me to, but hopefully that was...
No, I love Adam Grant's work as well, and the distinction he makes between smart giving and unsmart giving, right? And I found that nuance extremely profound to say... Yeah. And he also says giving is a high beta choice, right? If you don't give smartly, you might end up at the bottom of the pile and as a doormat. But if you're smart, then you could be giving and successful rather than a trade-off.
So he refers to them as adrish givers versus selfless adrish givers. Yeah.
Correct.
Right.
Lovely. Back to just picking up on the piece you mentioned, Raj. Mm-hmm. How do we rewire our mindset, right? And the reason I mention it is, when I think about India, a country like India, where you need, there is a certain level of, at least the, some of the choices we've made and the path we've taken, it's required us to be competitive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a certain edginess often is required by the system for you to get to a certain point. Mm-hmm. And then we suddenly flip the switch to say, you know what, you need to change from this, and maybe going back, that edginess requires a certain, at least a mindset of scarcity, saying if you don't make it here, then this is your, you know, you're missing out on a different orbit. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you get to a point, and then you need to behave differently with an abundance mindset. Do you see a tension there or a paradox there in terms of how we need to flip the switch at some point, and that's hard?
Not really, Deepak. I don't think you need scarcity at all, you know, in my opinion. I think what you do need is hard work. You need smart work. You need to identify something that you're intrinsically motivated by. And the scarcity mindset we mistakenly believe is needed for us to put in that hard work. And if I did not have that scarcity mindset, if I did not have this feverish desire to overcome my circumstances and get out of you know, the hellhole I'm in, I'm not going to succeed. Okay. And mm-hmm. I don't think that that negativity, that insecurity, stress, anxiety, etc., is needed at all. I think if you love what you do, you can very easily motivate yourself through that love rather than through that feeling of scarcity. I do think that there are certain contexts in which scarcity mindset is very useful. If you're in a war zone, if you are, you know, in a, say even in a slum, like the slum that I talked about, perhaps, okay. But if you're in a middle class family and what you're going to end up doing is not fighting like in a war, physical fighting, but you're going to do intellectual work, creative work, I don't think the scarcity mindset is needed at all. And I don't know if you know this about Adam Grant, right? One of his kind of stories is that he was a diver, right? And he was pretty good. And he got to the level where he was competing at the national level. And in one of the national competitions, the final one, for the gold medal and stuff like that, he noticed his competitor doing some mistake, okay? And he was wondering whether to go tell him that, you know, if you just correct for this, you're going to actually be much better. And he thought, okay, if I do that, maybe I know I'm going to help him and I'm going to sacrifice my own gold medal, but it's fine. You know, I'll go tell him. And I did that. And indeed, that's exactly what happened. The other guy got the gold and Adam himself got the silver medal. The next year comes around and exactly the same thing happens with another guy. Okay. But he goes ahead and again bites the bullet and tells the other guy that if you just do this, you're going to be a much better diver. And the other guy ends up winning the gold again. Okay. So Adam decides that, well, you know, two times it's hurt me being a giver. So I want to kind of focus on this topic and research it. So he ended up not going down the diving route, but ended up becoming a professor after pursuing a PhD. And what he found is that givers in the long run end up succeeding. Okay, in the short run, sure, you know, you help other people out, you prop them up, you know, they climb over your shoulders and go ahead, right? Especially if they're takers, they're not going to help you back up, okay? But in the long run, particularly in the kind of environment in which we live now, a lot of social media and things like that, word gets around, you're much, much better off being a giver, okay? Again, I mean, I want to kind of point this out that being insecure, being anxious, being jealous, envious of other people, and being scarcity-minded can certainly light a fire under your backside to motivate you to do things, okay? And that can lead to success. But that success is going to come at a huge cost to your well-being and perhaps even to your long-term success. It's much better to be on a solider, much better platform of loving what you do, being nice to other people. And I think that you'll see that not only does it make you a happier person, it also makes you a much more successful person in the long run.
Got it. Got it. No, point well taken. Talking about a different adjacent topic of abundance and scarcity, you talk about the notion of time scarcity or time abundance. Mm-hmm. And you talk about the paradox here that more successful we are, the more time strapped we feel. Mm-hmm. Why is that so? I mean, you also speak about a few ideas for reducing the perception of time. Right. Mm-hmm. One of them is sort of looking at awe-inspiring images and so mm-hmm. on. So I found this whole concept quite interesting. Could you talk about this?
Yeah, sure. So I'm sure that everybody can relate to this, right? Certainly people are listening to you, have access to internet, and so they belong to a certain socioeconomic class, I would imagine. All of us end up feeling strapped for time, right? And I do this as a kind of a quick survey of my class, in my MBA class and undergraduate class. Ask them, how many of you guys feel that you have more than enough time to handle everything that's thrown your way? Not a single hand goes up, okay? And then I ask the opposite question, which is that how many of you feel that you have less than enough time to do all the things that you want to do, and 24 hours is too little in a day, and every hand goes up, okay? And this has been happening for all the years that I've taught the class. Maybe two or three people in all these years have not raised their hand for the second question, mm-hmm. but everybody's feeling more and more frazzled, that life has become more fast-paced. They've bitten off more than they can chew. There's too many balls up in the air. Some are going to drop, and those are important ones, and so on. So we all face this sense of time scarcity, and much of the time, it's kind of like our own mistake. It's self-inflicted, you know? We just, you know, we have a FOMO, as it's called, right? Fear of missing out. And so we grab any opportunity that we get. We say yes to all the parties. We take on this, we take on that, and often to our own detriment. And I have to say that, you know, I myself am very guilty of this. Okay. And in a way, I don't mean to at all minimize the seriousness of the pandemic that we're facing right now, okay, COVID-19. But, you know, touch wood, so far I've been healthy, my family has been healthy, and of course my perspective is going to change on this if that were not to be the case. But I have to tell you that this has really been a kind of eye-opener for me in terms of how much it's simplified my life. You know, I can't go out. I can't take on all the assignments that I had lined up. I was going to go to Spain for something called the Happiness Walk. I was going to go give talks at different corporations. And I just can't do it because of this lockdown. And it's been so good, Deepak, in terms of just this time affluence, you know, having a sense of more time on my hands. And also a sense of connecting with my family, just sitting down and playing board games, for example, in the evening. You know, everyone's home. It's a much, much simpler life. And that's what it is. You know, this time scarcity versus abundance, or affluence, as they call it, time affluence, actually, makes you kind of rewind back to what we imagine to be simpler times. You know, that people had lots of times to go for a walk and reflect on their day's happenings and talk to each other about things that were meaningful to each other and so on and so forth. And that sense of time affluence is critical if you want to be happy. It's slightly separate from this mindset of abundance, which has to do with me feeling that I have more than enough of resources, that I don't need to be greedy and, you know, self-centered and grab things. But I do think that the connection is that time affluence leads to or promotes a sense of the mindset of abundance. And if you are time scarce, then I think it's less likely that you'll find it, find yourself adopting that mindset of abundance.
And maybe just persisting with this for a couple of minutes, Raj, you know, and even linking it back to Adam Grant's work around giving, right, during these times, you know, there is, you know, we have finite time in a day, and there is an opportunity for us to say, you know, there's so much more we can do and give and give and give and load the plate. And that at some level could be personally draining. I think Adam Grant also uses the term generosity burnout at some level, right? Talk about this. How do you think about that, solving for personal happiness versus solving for impact? Again, do you see a tension there? How do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? So in Adam Grant's book, there's also this, he talks about this in Give and Take, that if you look at somebody who's a selfless giver, right? At some level, you're talking about a person who's a selfless giver, who just takes on every opportunity that they get to give, and they're giving indiscriminately to anyone who asks them for any help, anytime, and so on. It's kind of sad, I mean, because they are the kind of epitome of giving at some level, right? But sad that they actually end up burning out faster. And so if you have a graph, if you can imagine a graph in your mind's eye with time on the x-axis and the positive impact that you have had on the y-axis, the selfless givers, even though they are probably the poster children of somebody who's truly an altruist, they end up burning out faster. So you can imagine in your mind's eye, kind of a volcanic eruption of giving, but that's it. It's over. Okay. Maybe 2 years, 5 years down the road, it's over because they burnt out. Now, if you think of somebody like who's an other-ish giver, who also takes care of themselves in the process of giving, and if you look at their graph, they might actually end up having a career of giving, so to speak, of 30, 40, 50 years. And although it might look insignificant compared to the volcano in the initial 3, 4, 5 years, if you kind of like fast forward 40 years and kind of zoom back on that graph, you'll see that what they've achieved is far, far, far more significant. Okay. So it's very, very important to kind of take care of yourself. Okay. Here, I think that there's also another concept that is very useful. And that concept is the concept of self-compassion, right? So taking care of yourself, you know, treating yourself like you would other people who need help is super, super important as well, which kind of, you know, at some level, perhaps to some people, they're asking themselves, well, this is getting confusing now because I thought that being a giver is good. And now you're saying that, you know, take care of yourself. Then how do I know that I'm not becoming a taker or at least a matcher? And there's no real kind of hard and fast, you know, non-porous kind of boundary between these things. Ultimately, it comes down to intention at some level. You know, am I doing this for the sake of societal benefit, or am I doing it in order for, you know, my own progression, and it's going to come at a cost to other people? And I think that if you're doing more of the latter, then you're not a giver. You're not a true giver. So it really comes down to you, right? At the end of the year, you have to introspect and ask yourself and be honest in answering this question. Am I taking care of myself so that I can be better prepared for more giving in the future? And the answer is yes, then you're being an otherish giver. And that's a very, very important thing to do.
Got it. Got it. And back to maybe just quickly wrap up the point around time affluence. Mm-hmm. You talk about a few ideas for reducing the perception of time. Could you talk about the couple of nuances there?
Yeah. So, you know, things that, you know, I find that very interesting. So, you know, I interviewed Melanie Rudd, who's one of the co-authors on that paper that talks about time affluence after encountering images that induce a sense of awe. If you think about awe, right, awe is an emotion that we feel when we are confronted with something that is far grander than ourselves, right? And usually you would imagine that encountering something like that makes us feel little and belittled, and we end up being humiliated or insulted, or, you know, feeling like we are not powerful, not very positive. But in fact, you know, being in front of, I don't know, El Capitan, right, at Yosemite. By the way, I mean, I just saw this movie called Free Solo a couple of days back. I highly recommend it. For those who haven't watched it. So, or in front of the Grand Canyon, or, you know, in front of the Himalayas, the mountains, rivers, things like that, or the galaxy, you know, we're just watching the Milky Way on a nice night, inspires you with this feeling of smallness. And somewhat kind of paradoxically, that smallness is actually a good feeling. And it makes you feel that, you know what, I think what it does is it makes you feel that life has existed. There are so many things beyond my control. There's so many big, beautiful things. You know, why am I worrying about things that are going on in my life and getting really stressed out and worked up about it? You know, I'm going to be gone in 80, 100 years. And let me just have a good time in the meanwhile. You know, so it kind of induces this sense of time abundance or time affluence in the short run. It's not a permanent change, obviously. Okay. But I think that it is a very useful hack. So whenever you're feeling really stressed out, I think it might be a good idea to kind of, you know, take a look at one of the, nowadays we have, you know, things on YouTube, right? So just look at size of the Earth compared to the universe. So just Google something like that. And it definitely works for me. You know, it induces a sense of time affluence.
Got it. Got it. Just moving topics, Raja, you talk about the happiness paradox, where you say that while it's often the final objective, we get distracted by focusing on the means rather than the end, right? Mm-hmm. And you talk about the notion of leaving a lot of happiness on the table by the choices we make. Could you talk to us about the insight here?
Yeah. So in a way, this is also related to some of the misconceptions about happiness, if you will, in the sense that we tend to, first of all, most of us, I don't think it's very many people who would disagree with this, that, you know, we prioritize happiness. You know, we think happiness is very, very important. You know, by happiness, again, I don't mean necessarily only pleasure, but, you know, fulfillment, a sense of meaning. I don't think there's too many people who disagree that if it's not the top goal, then very much in the top three, you know, right up there. So you would imagine that as people go about their daily lives, they are acting in ways that maximize that thing that they themselves claim is very important, happiness, right? But what we have discovered is that people will say, you know, that A, between A and B, A will make me happier. And yet when you observe people going about making choices between A and B, they routinely choose B, okay? So that's what we mean by a happiness paradox. And I'll give you a very specific example here, right? When it comes to relationships, we often know this, that sometimes, you know, you can either be right or you can be happy, okay? You get into a big argument with your spouse on something that is really worthless, you know, whether, you know, you said something and they misremembered it, and you know, they're saying that you said it and you say no, okay, and you can go on arguing about it, or just, you know, kind of bite your ego and say that I think you're right, okay, I'm really sorry, okay. There's nothing that's lost by doing that. Of course, you know, people then immediately say that, what if I keep doing it, and then they take advantage of me, right? And maybe in some instances that's true, okay, but in most instances, I think most of us are guilty of pursuing something that doesn't make us happy, doesn't make the other person around us happy that we care for. And so in that indirect way as well, reduces our happiness. And yet we end up doing it, okay? And it's not just things that have to do with being right versus being happy. It's got to do with chasing money beyond a point at which it's giving us happiness. We talked about, you know, FOMO. So chasing opportunities beyond a point where you stretch thin and yet you want to grab onto this next opportunity to do this thing. Why? You know, what's it going to get you, right? We bite off more than we can chew, sacrificing our own happiness. We want that next, iPhone or the next gadget. And so chasing material things, becoming materialistic, chasing money, chasing power, chasing fame. So we end up exhibiting this phenomenon that I call the fundamental happiness paradox, okay, which is the discrepancy between what we claim is very, very important for us, which is happiness, and how we end up acting, which is we sacrifice happiness in the bargain, or instead of kind of pursuing happiness, we end up pursuing other goals. So we sacrifice happiness for the sake of other goals. So that's what I call the happiness paradox. And that's the concept there. Okay. And of course, in the book, I go through quite a few examples, and I'm happy to go through a couple of them here if you think that would be helpful.
Sure. I think a couple of examples would help.
Yeah. So one example is jobs, right? So what we did with the University of Texas students is we had them read two job descriptions. So one of the jobs was described as highly intrinsically motivating. This is the kind of job that you feel like every day when you wake up, yes, I want to get to work, right? But doesn't pay you a whole lot of money. Not that, you know, it's the pittance. It pays only pittance. It pays you enough for you to lead a decent life, not an extravagant life, right? And job B, that is going to pay you a lot of money. It's considered a very prestigious job, but really the job sucks, right? I mean, what you're doing for work is demeaning at some level, and you're surrounded by toxic colleagues, okay? And we ask people, which of these two jobs would you choose for yourself, okay? And what we find to be really interesting is that most of the people say that, you know, the job A that's intrinsically motivating, even if it's not going to pay as much, is the job that I want, right? Then they say this especially well before the interview season has begun. And so what we do is in the study, we ask them about 6 months before the interview season, here are actual job descriptions, okay? One of them is going to be more intrinsically motivating than the other. And we kind of take down these descriptions from previous year's job offers and their descriptions. And we see a significant effect of prioritizing intrinsic motivation over extrinsic 6 months before. But come interview season, it flips, okay? It flips. And people are much more likely to then choose during the interview season the extrinsically motivating job, the job that gives them more money, even if it comes at a cost to their sense of sanity or their sense of interest in the job. And the more prestigious jobs, the higher paying jobs, the more well-known jobs, well-known companies rather, those are the jobs that they end up choosing. And so it's in a way a kind of a very sad, but also very powerful demonstration of the fundamental happiness paradox, where even for things that actually matter to you a lot, you know, your job matters, we end up spending 100,000 hours on average at work, right? Which is at least half of the time that we are awake on Earth, okay? So not counting sleep time, we spend about one third to a half of our time at work, and yet we end up choosing something that's not going to make us as happy, all right? Hmm. So I can walk you through another example too if you want.
No, this is good. And I used to be a search consultant for 6 years, right? So this sort of hits home quite hard in the way it goes back to my conversations with candidates on how they think about choices. And you're right. I was going to pick up from there and maybe link this conversation, Raj, to some of the work of Bob Keegan, right? Who's done some work around adult development. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about midlife, right? And to use Bob Keegan's language, a lot of people are moving from a socialized mind to a self-authoring mind. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I was trying to get to was, while you spoke about the experiment at an undergrad level in terms of how students respond to job description one versus two.
Mm-hmm. We did it with the undergrads too, but this particular study I described was with the MBAs.
Okay, MBAs, got it. Now I was curious about how you think about this evolving as people age, and specifically maybe reflecting on this whole phase of midlife. Any reflections on what are some of the things you've seen, maybe looking at your peer set, maybe as a point of reference? Any thoughts or insights here?
So one thing is very clear, right? I think that the midlife years are among our worst. I think the teenage years are the absolute worst. But after that, I mean, our happiness tends to pick up a little bit. And the 20s are very good. But the midlife years between 45, let's say, and around 50, maybe 55, those are the worst. And one of the big reasons for that is that that's a time at which, you know, you can't delude yourself anymore that you haven't been as successful as some of your peers have been, and you haven't achieved many of the life goals that you wanted to achieve. Maybe objectively speaking, you're better off than what you imagined you would be, but relatively to other people, you're not. And so there's a big gaping hole in the middle of you wondering, you know, why did I kind of run around chasing all this? And here I am, and I don't feel as happy. I'm getting older. I've got a big belly now. And you just end up not being very happy. And that's the reality, right? I mean, this is not among my peers necessarily. It's the reality of the around the world. This is what the curves show, the happiness curve across the ages. Okay. Uh-huh. And I think that one of the kind of interesting things is that it does kind of tick up after it, right? It goes up. And one of the big reasons why that happens is that you end up kind of, you know, reconciling whatever has happened and kind of going past it and not being as concerned about it or worried about, you know, running after all the conventional yardsticks and competing with other people and so on. And one thing that I do want to say here, Deepak, is that earlier on you talked a little bit about this podcast being about transitions and career transitions and all that. So I do have some thoughts on if you are in that age group, right, say between 40 and 50 or 40 and 55, and you're discovering that this has not been a happy time for you, you're, you know, certainly not as happy as you thought you ought to be at this point. And perhaps you also recognize that given everything I have, I actually ought to be really happy. And yet here I am not feeling very happy. I do have some thoughts. I don't know if
we should talk about that now. Now is a good time, Raj, to dive into that.
Okay. So one thing is that, you know, so I want to talk about three things that you can do if uh-huh. that is what you're experiencing, okay, that you're here. And, you know, most of the listeners are probably going to be in this category of people who have actually achieved quite a bit, okay, in terms of conventional success and access to resources and money and power and status and all that. And yet they have this kind of sense of emptiness, right? Part of that, I think, comes from social comparisons to other people. Right. And I think that there's a time at which you need to stop doing that, or at least mitigate it to a large extent, because if there's one really big killer of happiness, it is social comparisons. OK, it's easy to do. It's natural to do. It seems that sometimes it's helpful to do it because you get inspired by other people or you realize what's possible. And so you chase that for yourself. But if it's a state in which you more or less constantly exist, where you're comparing yourself to other people to such an extent that it's even become second nature to you, then you're really killing yourself, right? At some level, literally, because if you're unhappy, you're actually kind of, you know, not helping yourself in terms of your health, your physical health. So you need mm-hmm. to mitigate it. And I would say that what's far more important than all these, you know, resources and comparisons to other people is having a sense of purpose and meaning. That is that feeling that what you're doing for work is intrinsically motivating. It is tapping into your core interests. It is tapping into and nurturing your strengths that you've built up over time. So that is very, very important. And also the sense that you're actually helping other people out, okay? Be it consumers, be it your coworkers, be it, you know, people who don't have a, you know, this thing is voice in the system, right? Animals perhaps, or poor people from other countries. Somebody, you're helping some stakeholder out. So these two, at least one of these two is very, very important, right? Even if you're not helping mm-hmm. other people out, at least are you really into your job? Okay, and mm-hmm. if you're not doing that, then I have kind of three pieces of advice, really. And this is all based off of other people's research, okay? So one mm-hmm. is that see if you can job craft, okay? I don't know if your listeners are familiar with this term, but it's basically moving your job in a more meaningful direction, right? So, you know, I think that I'm a good candidate to speak about it because earlier we talked a little bit about this, right? Why did I end up teaching a class on happiness? I think at some level, I didn't know the word job crafting at that time, but that's what I was doing, you know? I was teaching regular marketing courses. I'm in the marketing department even to this day, but I felt a little bit uneasy about some of the larger ripple effects that the knowledge that I was imparting was having on the world at large. And so I ended up concluding that it's not as meaningful for me to do that. And so I thought to myself, what would be more meaningful is to talk about well-being, happiness, etc. So I ended up crafting job crafting, right? So that's one thing you can do. And people are often very surprised to learn that if they do attempt to job craft, they actually do not end up facing a lot of obstacles, okay? And they end up actually getting, people open up new doors of opportunity for them even within their own firm, okay? And it doesn't have to be massive and big, right? You could be in sales, for example, and you discover that, you know, it's really making you travel more than you want to, and you have family at home and kids, and you're away from them. And in the meanwhile, you've gathered a lot of insights on what kinds of products people want. And so you could actually kind of really help out in the R&D, okay, in the new product group or innovation group. And so most people think that, well, you know, I've spent a, you know, good 15, 20 years in sales, and who's going to accept me in R&D? Okay, there's no way that they're going to accept me. But you'd be surprised, you know, if you just go and talk to your boss or to other people in the R&D department, even if it's only for, you know, a temporary period, if you ask them to kind of, you know, spend time for about, say, 6 months in that R&D area, you might actually encounter a lot more receptivity than you thought. Okay, so that's one, job crafting. The second is, of course, you know, that you move jobs. And let's say that, you know, again, with this example of sales versus R&D, let's say that your company actually tells you that, no, you know, you don't have experience with that, and we already have all positions full. Sorry, you can't do it, right? One thing you can do is to hang out with the R&D group. You know, even if they don't allow you to actually take up a formal position there, right? Just hang out with that group and say that, you know what, every evening I just want to spend 1 hour with you guys, you know, just to see what you're doing and just listen in. You know, I'm not going to actually work here, but I at least want to know what you're doing, right? If you take another example, okay, let's say that you are an accountant, okay, and your heart is in, say, scuba diving or something. Okay, just go spend time at a scuba diving shop, okay, and volunteer your time and find out what it takes to kind of own a scuba diving shop and go on more scuba diving trips, okay? The idea is that you end up kind of building a set of what might be called tacit knowledge, you know, not formal knowledge, but knowledge that's kind of maybe implicit, difficult to kind of articulate in words, but you end up discovering, you know, the community that's into that. You end up discovering what aspects of the job that you thought you'd really like, you actually end up hating, okay? Maybe you don't like the idea of, you know, filling up tanks every evening, okay? And you thought that that somehow wasn't part of the job of owning a scuba diving shop. So that's the idea that, you know, over time, spending 2, 3, 4, 5 years even sometimes in that area that you thought might be more fulfilling for you will end up kind of revealing to you whether it actually is something that would be fulfilling or it was just one of your aspirational dreams, right? And what this lady Herminia Ibarra has discovered in her book, Working Identity, is that people who take that path of slowly kind of branching out rather than taking this discontinuous jump from what you're doing to what you think might be your passion is a much, much more stable way to transition out of the job that you find meaningless to a job that you find more meaningful. What's happening in those 3, 4, 5 years is that even though it sounds like a long time, you're actually, you know, you're on a journey there, right? You're on a journey away from your currently meaningless job towards a job that's going to be more meaningful, but it's not something that a journey that requires you to abandon all your present contacts and your family and put them, you know, in jeopardy by doing that. You're taking everybody along for the ride a little bit and you're communicating with them on what's going on. And that's a much better path to take, a slow and organic path, I call it. And the third thing that you can do, sorry, did you want to say something?
I just wanted to say that I'm a big fan of Herminia Ibarra, and she was on the podcast a while back as well. So completely
wonderful. Yeah. Okay.
On that.
Okay. All right. So, and the last one is really, you know, let's say that both of these paths are not available to you, right? I mean, the job crafting, you can't do it. And you really can't kind of afford to, you know, spend any more time pursuing what you think might be a second career. Volunteering for a scuba diving shop, for example, then, you know, at least, the very least, pick up a hobby that's intrinsically motivating for you, okay? Maybe it is solving jigsaw puzzles, right? Maybe it's learning about, I don't know, Greek history, okay? Nowadays, we have access to so many different resources, right, on the internet that I think it would be a shame if we didn't pursue our hobbies. And it turns out, there's lots of work on this, that if you even if you have a job in which you're not into it, it's not meaningful, but you have a set of hobbies that you're into and it's highly meaningful for you, deeply satisfying, that's going to overflow into affecting your job satisfaction. So that's the very least that we can do, I would say.
Got it. Actually, one of the other guests on the podcast, Stu Friedman, uses the term psychological spillover, where he talks about how you feel about a certain domain and how that spills over into a different domain. So possibly there's a little bit of that happening. Lovely. Moving to a different theme, Raj, there was an interesting anecdote which I couldn't just not pay attention to, which was about happier batsmen having better averages than other cricketers. So looks like we may not have the IPL this year in India, but I guess you can't take cricket out of an Indian's mind. Talk to us about this piece of work. What's the inside of it?
So again, I really have to apologize. I know that I mentioned that statistic or that paper in my book, but it's been a long time since I read it. And I think, if I remember correctly, that was a paper that got published in the early 90s even. Okay. And you can look up the reference in my book. So I don't remember the details of it, but it is, as you mentioned, it is this finding that happier batsmen have better averages. And I don't know if you follow cricket to the extent where you have a little bit of an idea of the happiness of some of the Indian batsmen or how happy they look. Certainly Dhoni seems like a very calm guy, maybe not a happy guy, but a very calm guy. And some of the other people, may not be as capable of regulating their emotions than other people, Kohli might on the face of it appear like he's not in control of his emotions, but I think he's just a bit of an exception, definitely, but also very, very good at channeling his energy and into becoming focused, So I don't think he's an unhappy guy. If you contrast them with somebody like, we're talking about people who are in the national team or have been, and so they're obviously kind of like very, very, very good, right? But even within that group, somebody like an Ambati Raidu, if you take him, from my understanding, just reading on Crick Info and stuff, he doesn't seem like a guy who gets along very well with other people. So that might be a reason why he got dropped. Anyway, this is, not really a scientific analysis. Okay. I apologize for that. And I don't remember that article in detail. So.
Got it. No problem. But maybe moving to another theme that you talk about, you spoke about earlier in our conversation, Raj, you speak about prioritizing, but not pursuing happiness. Right. And it's a bit like falling asleep, right? The harder you try, the harder it gets. How do we walk this tightrope, and where's the line?
Yeah, so some time back, I talked a little bit about this idea of what does prioritizing mean, and how is it different from chasing happiness or pursuing happiness. And the idea is that very similar to how if you prioritize sleep, you would basically adopt a set of habits that make it more likely that you're going to get a good night's sleep. And they could be things like exercising, right? We know that we are more likely to get better sleep if we are physically tired. Likewise, you can do some other things like not have a huge meal before going to sleep. That's going to maybe upset your stomach, or not get into an argument with your wife on which TV channel to watch, for example, right, or your spouse. Okay. Things like that, maybe taking a warm shower. Actually, there's a very, very good book on this topic. Maybe you've read it. It's called Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker. And he talks.
He was on the podcast as well, actually, interestingly enough.
Wow. Okay. You've really gotten a lot of very, very influential people on your podcast. So I'm very honored now.
I think it's one third of our life. So I was curious about his insights. It was a very insightful conversation.
Okay. Yeah. So you probably know that, he talks about at least five things that you can do, including going to sleep at the same time every day and night, setting your room temperature to be a little bit low, not consuming too much alcohol or coffee, and so on. Right. That's how you would prioritize getting sleep, good night's sleep. And what you wouldn't do is get really upset if you're not immediately able to fall asleep because you're chasing the sleep, right? And you as you're lying down, watching out for when you're about to fall asleep and say, there, I almost fell asleep. So if you do that, it's actually going to be counterproductive. And in a very similar way, if you wanted to be happy, just, you know, pursue those things that you know from past experience make you happier. You know, don't bite off more than you can chew. Have a sense of time affluence in your life. Don't chase superiority. Find something meaningful to do, you know, help other people out, and so on. And then I think that happiness you'll just discover kind of emerges as a you know, reliable byproduct. It's a question of probability. Of course, it's never 100% guaranteed, but you can kind of, you know, bet really that you're going to be more happy if you put those things in place. That's what I mean by prioritizing happiness.
And picking up on the thing you mentioned, Raj, which is about pursuing flow rather than chasing superiority, you specifically allude to athletes, right? And you talk about the fact that there needs to be an intrinsic desire to win. But the moment the match finishes, you need to, and you end up on the other side, you need to be detached to the outcome, right? I'm curious about how athletes make that switch happen. How do we ensure we give our best up to a point and then suddenly completely flip in case the results don't play our play in our way? What's your observation there?
Yeah, so that's, you know, it's a big topic, right? And I don't know how a lot of the athletes who are very good at it do it. Hats off to them, because, you know, obviously they're elite athletes, and yet it's not, you know, it's actually not even so much what happens after the game is over, right? Of course, the gracious athletes are willing to kind of acknowledge that the other player was better and so on. But even going from one point to one moment in the match to the next, right? You really goofed up in the previous point, same tennis. Are you going to be able to now forget what happened and really focus on what's going on in this point right now, right? That ability to compartmentalize at some level your mind and really get into a deep focus in this moment is a very, very important thing. And, you know, lots of books have been written about it. This book that I like on this topic is The Inner Game of Tennis. I don't know if you've come across this book.
No.
Wonderful book. So when you talk about how do you kind of, you know, set a goal, right, that you're deeply, deeply passionate about and pursue it with a lot of passion, vim and vigor and enthusiasm, do everything you can to achieve that goal. And yet in the moment when the goal is not achieved, not wallow in self-pity and misery, and, you know, you become resilient even at that point and optimistic for the future. And maybe you kind of re-engage with that goal and re-pursue it, or you change your goal slightly because, you know, for whatever reason that wasn't achievable, or you learn from it and pursue an entirely different goal. How do you kind of go about that? It's a very fascinating topic, you know. And I think that we as Indians are lucky in the sense that we have the Bhagavad Gita, right? I mean, something that we all grew up with. And I think that the core message of that, at least as far as I understand it, right? I'm not a religion major or anything like that by any means. But the core message is very much on point, right, on this topic, that you pursue your duties or your goals, right? Whatever your duties are, you try to fulfill them, and yet you don't get emotionally affected if you don't achieve your goals, right? Or for that matter, even if you do achieve it, you don't kind of you know, take a sense of pride. It's not about your ego, and you achieved it, and you're better than other people. And so, I think therein lies the trick a little bit, you know, that A, when you do succeed, it's not a matter of ego and pride and what's called hubristic pride. You maybe are grateful for the fact that you were able to achieve that goal, for all the people that helped you out in helping you achieve that goal. And so there's more of a sense of gratitude, perhaps, that flows out of that. And if you can do that, then I think that will be a little bit easier for you to kind of switch, you know, when you do fail, from wallowing in self-pity to maybe kind of being graceful. But the other thing that is very, very important that I found very useful that I talk about in the book, I call it the dispassionate pursuit of passion. And maybe I can spend a few minutes talking about it. But the idea is that when you do fail, you know, it's an outcome that our mind is categorized as a bad thing, as an undesirable thing. But if you were to kind of look back on your life's experiences, I think that you will agree. And most people I've asked, you know, to engage with me on this exercise. I call it the reminisce and reflect exercise. Basically, the exercise involves recalling an event that was negative, and then asking yourself, how do I feel about it now? Okay. And what I find is that if that event that people recall, and I, you know, have some people recall a event that happened in the distant past, 2 years or before that, or I have some other people recall an event from the recent past, 2 months or within 2 months. And so what I found is that reliably, I find this, right, that so long as sufficient water has flown under the bridge, that is, that it's 2 years or more, that's in the distant past, the negative events are no longer considered as negative. Okay, and sometimes they're actually considered a positive thing now. You know, so I have had people say to me things like, "Oh, you know, when I broke up with my girlfriend right after college, okay, that was maybe 13 years back. It was like devastating for me. Okay, end of the world. But now I'm so happy that I did not get married to that person, because later I discovered she was completely cuckoo," right? Things like that. Or I broke a bone when I was in my 12th grade, and it ruined my holidays after the 12th. I really wanted to enjoy. I wanted to travel. I wanted to play cricket. And here I was stuck in a hospital bed. But you know what? Because of that, now that I think about it, I ended up learning C++ programming, because I was lying down in bed and I had nothing to do. And that's when I ended up discovering that I was truly deeply passionate about software programming. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the point is that when we encounter outcomes, we look at it with a very narrow frame of mind, and even narrow-minded frame of mind. And we think of that as a negative outcome, and we're convinced that it's negative. And the fact that we're convinced that it's negative actually makes it more negative, or makes it negative, when it in reality may not have been negative at all. Okay. It may be exactly the thing that you need in order for you to grow and learn and to take advantage of new doors of opportunity that would not have opened up had that negative thing not happened. Okay, I'll give you an example from my own life. It's a very trivial one. You know, a few months back, I was on my way to New York City, and I was going to give a talk, and it ended up I ended up missing the flight. Okay, because there's a lot of traffic and buildup, and partly my mistake, but you know, I budgeted about 45 minutes to get to the airport. It usually takes about that time, but it ended up taking an hour and a half, and I ended up missing the flight. And it felt really bad at that point. Okay, but I'd been talking about this concept of dispassionate pursuit of passion, and you know, who knows whether an outcome is good or bad. Might as well think that every outcome is good, and that puts you in the best place. Okay, in short, that's what that is. Concept. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up thinking about it that way. And what ended up happening is that on the next flight, eventually the flight that I got, I was actually sitting next to a guy from a organization, and we ended up chatting about happiness in the workplace, and they invited me over to their organization to give a talk. And I now engaged with that organization for 3 years in a row. Okay. So this happened about 3 years back. Sorry. I might have said 3 months back, sometime back, but it happened a while back. I ended up doing a series of kind of workshops and consulting gigs with this organization, which has been deeply satisfying for me. Okay. So that's the idea, that when you do fail, when bad outcomes happen, you might think that that's the end of the world at that point in time. And maybe, you know, it's difficult to kind of pick yourself up immediately after it. But if you kind of remind yourself that, look, I mean, let me think back on my past negative outcomes. How do I feel about them? And if I don't feel as negative, and I think that they, in fact, help me learn and grow, then why can't this particular negative outcome also turn out the same way later on? You know, and if that is true, then at least you can start feeling the glimpses of positivity. You know, you can kind of see the light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak, you know, rather than feeling devastated. So that's the idea.
Got it. Got it. And maybe just going back to one of the things we might have discussed is already, but maybe just to sharpen the understanding, Raj, you speak about pursuing flow rather than chasing superiority, right, mm-hmm. as one of the ways of enhancing our happiness levels. And maybe just to make it real, you know, one hears about tennis players and painters and so on pursuing flow, but let's say people in the corporate world, right, mm-hmm. Business leaders who are in transition, how do they, what's your suggestion around how they could discover what gives them flow?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is again, you know, a very big topic. And one of the ways in which I feel that our education systems fail us around the world, maybe especially in places like India, although there's lots of positive things that can be said about the education system in India too, is that they don't really help us understand where our passions lie, right? Rather, we go after things that, you know, are going to pay the bills and will make us a lot of money and so on. So we sacrifice our intrinsic interests for the sake of extrinsic rewards. And you brought this up earlier too, that, you know, chasing superiority seems like a good thing to do until you reach a certain point. I think that one of the very important things for people to experience more flow in their lives is to start at the beginning, which is to understand what is it that is intrinsically motivating for me. Okay, you might be familiar with work of Sir Ken Robinson. He's written a book called The Element, right? Maybe he was on your podcast too. I'm not sure.
Not yet.
Okay. he talks about this intersection between what you're good at and what you enjoy doing, and he calls it the element. And I think it's very, very important to kind of identify that, because once you identify it, then there's a higher chance that you're actually going to put in Anders Ericsson says is the critical amount of time that you need in order to get to a level of mastery in a field, right? Which is ballpark around 10,000 hours. Of course, he says, you know, use that ballpark very loosely, but a lot of time, basically, okay? You're not going to put in those 10,000 hours if you pursue extrinsic rewards, because it's not deeply intrinsically motivating for you, okay? And even if you do end up putting those 10,000 hours, if you're pursuing extrinsic rewards, it's going to come at a cost to some other things that are important in your life, you know, your relationships, your health, etc. In this context, I should refer to this work of Robert Ballaron on pursuing passion with a sense of harmony versus obsession. And so that's the idea that, you know, if you want to have more flow in your life, not as an athlete, but working, let's say, as a professor or as an investment banker, it doesn't matter what field it is. You can have flow in any field. Then it's very, very important to pursue your passion. And that's the reason is that you're more likely to experience the kind of flow that's really immersive, what might be called high flow, when you have a high level of ability. Okay, at low levels of ability, you get to experience low flow or medium flow. You know, that's not very engrossing. It's not going to answer one of life's big questions, which is what is my purpose in life? Okay, it's when you experience high flow on a consistent basis, you know, maybe not everyday basis, but certainly every week basis, that's when you feel that, yeah, you know, I know what I was put on earth for. That's a very satisfying place to be. And for that to happen, you need to experience high flow on a relatively regular basis. And that in turn means that you need to have put in a critical amount of time, around 10,000 hours, pursuing that field. And that in turn means that you need to be intrinsically motivated. Otherwise, you can't stomach putting so many hours into that field. And so it kind of like, you know, in a chain of events, it goes back to starting with discovering where your element is. What am I good at? What do I enjoy doing? And then, you know, you have a high level of, I think, high chance, I should say, of ending up in a place of high level of mastery so that you can experience high flow. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. A couple of questions as we wrap up, Raj. Mm-hmm. One is maybe changing the topic to children, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a parent of two young kids, 10 and 6. What's been your research around raising happy kids? What are some of the things we should think about as parents, and where do you think people, what are common places where you see people trip in the way they think about raising children? Any insights there?
Yeah, sure. I actually just recently got a paper accepted that's coming out soon on the impact of parental love that children get experience uh-huh. when they are young, and the impact that that has on their future financial success. And we were very lucky to get hold of this data set from Canada, which followed the same set of respondents for about 25 years. These respondents are about 35, 40 years old now. And we got them from right around when they were about 5 years old to about 15 years old. And they responded with four waves of surveys. And it collected lots of things, including the level of love that these children got as kids. And the dependent variable is their financial success now, right? Mm-hmm. Which we define as not just how much money they have and how much money they perceive that they have. So subjective kind of success as well as more objective income level success. And also stress, you know, how much debt they have and how much credit card loans they have and so on. And what we find is that there is a really significant positive effect of parental love, okay, parental nurturance that these children get as kids. These respondents got as kids and where they are now financially in their life, okay? So in answering this question, I think it's useful to think about two kind of dimensions, okay? One is the amount of love that children get, which can be taken as, you know, whether the parents really, truly, deeply care for the children's well-being and are willing to kind of, you know, go out of their way to help them out. For example, you know, wake up at 4 in the morning if the children have to study and make them Horlicks or Bonvita or whatever, you know, and make sure that they're getting good quality sleep at night, make good food for them, you know, all kinds of normal things that you would think of, you know, in a loving mm-hmm. household. So you can envision this graph in your head, one dimension, the vertical dimension being amount of love that the kids get, low to high. And the other dimension is the amount of discipline that they get, right? Mm-hmm. That are the rules in the house and do they have to follow the rules? And if they're not followed, then they're disciplined, maybe through punishment, and maybe through other means, right? And so, mm-hmm. again, you can imagine low versus high, okay? And mm-hmm. these four cells that come out have actually been named. And the researcher that does a lot of work on this is, or used to do a lot of work, maybe she's not doing anymore, is a person named Baumrind, Baumrind. And so uh-huh. the high cell, right? High levels of uh-huh. love, high levels of discipline. That is called authoritative parenting, okay? Uh-huh. High levels of discipline, low levels of love, that's called authoritarian parenting. And you can think of Von Trapp, right? Uh-huh. Is it Colonel Von Trapp? Whatever, you know, so from the Sound of Music,
of course.
So he was authoritarian, right? I mean, a lot of discipline, mm-hmm. very little love until Maria comes into the household. Okay, and mm-hmm. the low levels of love, low levels of authority, discipline, that's called negligent parenting, where, you know, the kid is just abandoned, basically. No love, no discipline. If you have read this short story called Junius Maltby, I think that is probably negligent. Actually, maybe that uh-huh. is permissive, actually. You know, that's the fourth category, which is a lot of love and no discipline, okay? Uh-huh. And what we found is that, as far as we could tell, the discipline dimension wasn't that significant at all in our study, okay? So one of the things that we worry about is that if we don't discipline our kids when they're growing up, then they're going to end up being messed up. You know, they're not going to be able to be diligent in pursuing their passions. They're not going to put in those 10,000 hours and they're not going to be successful. They're going to fritter it all away. And that's a big, deep worry that a lot of parents have. Okay. And mm-hmm. I'm not saying that discipline is not important, but I think it's a little bit less important than we think it is. Okay. And if it comes to a compromise or a trade-off between love and discipline, I think that love should always trump. Love should always trump. Okay. And sometimes what we do, and we are very good at this as human beings, is that in the garb of love, we end up passing what is actually our pet desire, right? And so for mm-hmm. a very stark example of this, that, you know, we want our kids to really succeed in, let's say, playing the piano, right? And we give them, like, you know, very harsh, meet out harsh punishment if they end up not practicing enough, you know? We tell them that it's all for you. It's for you because I love you that I do this, okay? So mm-hmm. in the garb of love, we kind of end up being martinets, strict martinets that are even willing to psychologically punish our kids so that they achieve our goals. So I would say that as a parent, I think one thing you need to do is you need to kind of step back a little bit and ask yourself, why do I want them to achieve this goal? And really be deep, like truly honest to yourself about why, right? And I think that many parents will discover that one of the reasons why they want their kids to achieve these goals is because they themselves did not achieve these goals. Okay. So it's a kind of a vicarious way of fulfilling what happens to be your pet dream. And you want to, now that you failed in achieving it. And often it's the case that these parents themselves were probably subject to a lot of discipline without love from their parents. And at that point, they reacted violently against it or passive aggressively against it. And they didn't learn to play the piano as a kid or mridangam or what have you. And now they're kind of regretting it and they wish that they had actually learned. Okay. And they kind of, you know, absorb that blame to some extent. And now they're kind of like, it's like ragging, right? I mean, you just pass it on to the next generation. Okay. There's a much, much better approach. And the approach has got to do with love, You know, so if you truly want your kids to achieve this thing, you know, you want them to achieve, great heights in piano, then why don't you learn it yourself right now? Right. Sit down with them and practice with it rather than telling them, you know what, you go and practice next 2 hours. You're going to practice. I shouldn't hear a peep from you. I should only hear you play the piano. Right. And meanwhile, you're sitting there watching a sitcom or, one of these shows, soap operas on TV. What's that message, you know, to your kid? The message is that what they care about is my achievements. Okay. And I'm only loved to the extent that I achieve things. That's not a good message to send to your kid. Okay. It's going to mess them up. So you learn it yourself. You make it creative. Maybe tell them that, look, okay, let's figure out the song, okay, the piano for the song, and we're going to sit down and I'll learn how to play the guitar or I'll sing, okay, and I want you to kind of learn the piano, okay, and play the piano parts. And sit down with them, help them out, make it a game, gamify it, have a lot of laughter, a lot of creativity, a lot of love, and that's a much better approach, much better parenting approach, okay? So it's a very big area, right? I mean, how to raise happy kids. One of the other things that I would say very quickly is transmit messages to them that nurture a sense of abundance in them rather than a scarcity mindset, okay? So if they come back from a game of cricket, okay, rather than ask them, did you win? How much runs did you score? How many wickets did you take? Let the first question be, did you have a good time? Did you enjoy yourself? Okay? Did you help other people out? Okay? If you're playing a game in which that is relevant, like assists in basketball. Okay, so those are much better questions. In fact, Adam Grant, we talked about him quite a bit, right, earlier. One of the practices that he has on a daily basis, I think, maybe weekly, but certainly weekly, if not daily basis, is to ask his children, who did you help out? Who are the three people you helped out today, right? Because he knows that helping other people out is a much more reliable determinant of success than striving for superiority over other people. And so in a similar vein, we know that abundance-minded people are not just happier, they're more successful as well. So encourage this sense of abundance, okay? Ask them if they're pursuing their passion, if they're having fun, if they're enjoying themselves, if they're helping other people out, rather than encouraging social comparisons. You know, don't ask your child, okay, how come you're not reading big books like Amy does? You know, she's already finished the Harry Potter series and here you are still reading, you know, Tintin or something. Those kinds of things, you know, in the short run, it might make the kid insecure and make them pursue, goals. But in the long run, you're really messing them up. That's not a very good strategy at all.
Got it. Lovely, Raj. I don't want to end with a very open and a big question, but maybe since it's relevant for the times we're in, given coronavirus, we started with it, right? And a lot of us are homebound, especially in India. We are in a lockdown and we're not sure about the future. Any headline thoughts on how we can cope with the current situation happily, given everything that's unfolding around us?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, this is a great question. And believe it or not, the deans at my school, they want me to kind of talk about this. And, so I'm putting my thoughts together on this. And I think that one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to send out an email to my Coursera students to ask them what are the set of challenges that they're facing with this virus thing, right? And I just want to kind of know the lay of the land a little bit better before I offer any tips or suggestions for people. So I think that it's going to come down to like two or three groups, right? There is certainly one group that is suffering a lot because they're facing personal loss. Maybe they themselves are sick. And that is one group. And then there's a second group for whom it's highly anxiety provoking because the future is uncertain now. Okay. Maybe there are job security issues for them. If not for them directly, for somebody that is part of their family. Okay. So that is another group. And then there's of course the third group for whom this is going to be, as far as we can tell, a kind of a bit of a temporary hiccup. Okay. Even though it's long lasting, assuming that, you know, all of this passes over, you know, and 1 year from now, certainly 2 years from now, we just think of this as an event that happened without having any long-term consequences really on the, say, economy and things like that, you know, that group, right, for whom this is at some level, right, if you put things in perspective, it's a kind of a bit of source of frustration and irritation perhaps, but nothing much bigger or deeper than that, okay? So I can see that there are at least these three groups, and each of these three groups has differing levels of I'd say stress, anxiety-provoking things, elements in this. And each of these three groups needs an entirely different set of suggestions, I think, on how to deal with it, right? And I don't even want to, you know, begin to claim that I understand how people who have actually lost somebody or are in a, you know, situation where there's a big prospect of that happening, they're personally also suffering health-wise, you know, what they must be going through. It must be hellish, you know, and I don't know what I can offer there, right? For the second group that is facing this, you know, job loss prospects and huge amounts of uncertainty and stress, maybe even cash flow issues, things like that. Again, you know, I'm not in that situation myself, but I've certainly dealt with that kind of situation in my life. And there are other situations, not the pandemic, but other situations in which that's relatively commonplace, that kind of thing happens. And I can certainly talk about some things that one can do there. And for the third group, I can offer a lot of suggestions and advice. Okay. And for the second group, just very quickly, I'll just mention that, you know, it comes down to understanding and dealing with uncertainty. You know, that's the crux of it. I think that uncertainty is aversive for us as human beings. We'd like to have control. We like to be able to predict things, and any situation that causes a huge amount of uncertainty is hugely stressful for us. And in this case, if it's going to actually have an impact on our lifestyle, even level, you know, access to basic needs, some of the families are actually suffering from that, right? It just cut off their source of income, like daily wage earners, for example, even in the US, you know, plumbers, for example, things like that. It's going to be hugely stressful, but you know, so long as you have enough to kind of tide this over, and assuming that this is not going to be too long lasting, I think that if you have a better attitude towards uncertainty, you're going to come out better in the end. You know, not just come out better in the end, but also not feel as negative in the process. And dealing with uncertainty, you know, it goes back a little bit to that dispassionate pursuit of passion. You know, are there doors of opportunity that are opening up because of this negativity that would not have opened up had this thing not happened? And if you look at it from that perspective, I think that you'll actually, you know, I'm pretty sure that almost anyone can discover something in this situation that's a bit of a silver lining. And so the idea is to focus on that, expand that, make it bigger. Okay, if you're a plumber, for example, and you don't have this daily opportunity to earn a daily wage, maybe learn up about how to create an online website, okay? Maybe come up with an idea where you can kind of walk people through to fix their plumbing on the phone, okay? Just try and be creative to the extent that you can, you know, as best as you can. So things like that, you know, so that's what I would offer. And for the third group, where really, I mean, they can see that nothing big is going to happen, their jobs are secure, and it's just that they're having to deal with, you know, family members 24/7 all the time in cramped up spaces, and things are starting to kind of, you know, boil over a little bit. I think it's a great learning opportunity to practice some of the things that we know are very, very important for long-term happiness, including leading a healthy lifestyle. Maybe you can all, you know, as a family, practice a few healthy things, you know, make healthy food, try new recipes every day. I myself, you know, I work out at the gym every day if I can. But now that's not possible. And so I do a 20-minute kind of intense workout routine. I follow this lady called Pamela Reif. I think that's how you pronounce mm-hmm. her last name, R-E-I-F. Mm-hmm. And she's awesome. You know, it's pretty intense. I do the intense workout for 20 minutes in the evening. And in the morning, I follow somebody else called Sarah Beth Yoga. Sarah Beth is her name. And she's got nice 20, 30-minute routines, nice kind of easy-paced kind of yoga in the mornings. I do that. And as a family, what we've done is now that we spend so much time together, we have created this big board. And on the board, we basically have rows being days of the week and the columns being different times of the day, like morning, afternoon, and evening. And everybody gets to dictate or you know, plan for the rest of us, everybody in the family, an activity. Right. So, for example, we have an international student staying with us for the whole year. Her name is Linnea. She's from Germany. She's mm-hmm. lovely. And so she decided that yesterday evening we were going to spend between 5 and 7 p.m. Taking photographs. You know, this is a spring in Austin and we have lovely wildflowers. And there's a field right opposite our home where all these blue bonnets come up. And it looks really, really picturesque. And she said, let's go out there and wear blue so that it matches with the blue bonnets. And we're just going to take photographs. And so for 2 hours, we just took a bunch of photographs, which came out really well. And it's really interesting when you allow people to kind of, you know, say, okay, you get to choose, you decide whatever it is. Everybody has to not just participate in the activity, but actually be enthusiastic, not, you know, be a wet blanket. Even if you don't like the activity, just pretend like you like it, you know, just be a force of positivity rather than negativity. And just amazing what kinds of things that people have come up with. My daughter, she led us through a dance routine. She's a, you know, she's only 12 years old, but she's been dancing for, I don't know, I mean, 8 years. So she's very good at ballet and things like that. So she just taught us all these things. I know. And when you look at this dance, it just looks so simple and you think, yeah, I can do that. But once you start to actually do it, you realize, man, I mean, this is tough, right? This takes a lot of balance and coordination. My son, he held a table tennis competition. I've made them watch the free solo. I talked about it sometime back. My wife, you know, she came up with this idea of all of us are going to create a cartoon strip, right? And I thought, there's no way that we're going to be able to do it in 2 hours. But now with technology, you know, there's this I forget the name of the website, but you just go there. And then once you have a storyline, you can actually pick characters and literally cut and paste them into these panels. And you end
very
up
interesting.
Yeah, it's just awesome. So just be inventive, you know, just what is the saying, you know, when life gives you lemons, make lemonade, right? if you're, I think in the end, it boils down to feeling good from the inside out. You know, if you feel good from the inside out, you're more resilient, you're more creative, you come up with ideas and you make good things happen even in bad situations. And I think that that's the, you know, overarching kind of piece of advice or suggestion that I have for the third group.
Hope you found the conversation purposeful. If you're seeking value from the podcast, I would urge you to pause and pay it forward to Antarang Foundation, a not-for-profit based in Mumbai that works with children from challenging backgrounds and helps them acquire key life skills and enables them to find jobs. These are challenging times we are going through, and your help will mean a lot. You can either contribute financially to Antarang Foundation or hire from them. Here's Prashant Gupta, a startup founder and a former McKinsey partner and a corporate leader, speaking about his experience hiring from Antarang.
Hi, I'm Prashant and I run a business called Bandhu. Bandhu helps construction companies hire construction workers. We are working with alumni of Antarang Foundation, 2 girls and 1 boy, and it has worked out well so far. We were looking for people who could do outbound telecalling to Hindi-speaking construction workers all around the country, explain Bandhu's proposition to them, and if they are eager and open, then get them to register on Bandhu. It is a semi-scripted 3 to 5 minute conversation. All the three of these kids from Antarang have done a good job of getting trained on this and then doing the daily calls without any active supervision from us. They work from home and they use a smartphone for this job. They are registering a decent number of workers per day through their calling. They seem to have good energy and good work ethic, and looks like we might work with Antarang for other similar requirements as we go forward. I wish them all the very best in their endeavors. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To tune into the podcast archives, which contains interviews with 55 plus guests and counting, 500 plus nuggets curated across 60 odd themes, please visit playtopotential.com. To know more about the advisory work I do, please visit the About the Host section at playtopotential.com. Bye now.